Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas for another lecture as part of Einstein Fest. And this afternoon, we're very pleased to welcome Alice Calaprice as our lecturer. Alice Calaprice was born in Berlin, Germany, and is a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley. For almost 25 years, she worked at Princeton University Press, the official publisher of Einstein's collected papers. In 1978-80, she prepared a computerized index of the content of the Einstein Archive, some 42,000 documents, which was at the time located in Princeton, New Jersey, at the Institute for Advanced Study. Afterwards, she became a senior editor at the press, where she edited the 9 volumes of the papers that have been published to date. Alice Calaprice is a recipient of the Literary Marketplace's Award for Individual Editorial Achievement in Scholarly Publishing, and the author of 3 editions of the popular Quotable Einstein books, which have been translated into 22 languages. She is also the author, along with Trevor Lipscomb, She's also the author of the Einstein Almanac, Dear Professor Einstein, and co-author with Trevor Lipscomb of Albert Einstein, a biography, a book for teenage readers. It's just appeared in the last few months. We're very pleased to welcome her to Perimeter Institute. Please welcome Alice Calaprice.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for inviting me to this wonderful event. When I talk with friends and family about Einstein, I'm always struck by how everyone knows his name and his reputation for being a genius, but how little they actually know about his life, especially about his formative years before he became a bushy-haired old man. And usually what people do know is very much distorted, exaggerated, or just plain wrong. So I'm happy to have the opportunity to give this audience, including some kids I see, a very general overview of Einstein's long life without getting into the science for which he became most famous. First, let's consider why Einstein is so universally known and loved, and why he has retained such a worldwide high profile far beyond any of his 20th century contemporaries. 50 years after his death, he would be amused or maybe even alarmed at all the attention he's getting today. Why are we so fascinated by him? Surely his genius has something to do with his appeal. After all, he saw some revolutionary relationships in the physical world to which others had been blind for centuries, and some of his discoveries have left a lasting mark on our lives. But the world has admired Einstein not only because he was a nerd. What has made him memorable was not only his famous and by now well-studied brain, but also his many other interests and involvements. Besides his contributions to physics, we know him for his humanity, humility, and humanitarianism, his pacifism, and his strong opposition to the use of weapons as a way of settling differences among nations, his courage to speak his mind even when his reputation or life was in danger, his wry and sharp sense of humor, his resilience during hard times, his support of the Jewish people and of blacks in America, and even his spirituality, which he expressed in his profound admiration of the natural world. Despite all of these positive traits, Einstein wasn't perfect, and like all of us, had his share of faults. But in my opinion, most people remember Albert Einstein for his captivating physical image and his idiosyncrasies. The twinkle in his eye, his uproarious laughter, his rumpled clothes and sockless feet, and most of all, his big hair. I think we have, oh, this is later, okay. But who would have guessed when Albert was born? Let me bring this back. But who would have guessed when Albert was born that he would become such an icon? Certainly not his parents, Hermann and Pauline Einstein. Sorry, I think I'm going. Yeah, here they are. Pauline was only 18 when she became a mother, but Hermann was already the ripe old age of 29 and busy trying to establish himself in the new business of electrical contracting. When Albert was born in Ulm in southern Germany on March 14, 1879, his parents were in fact quite alarmed when they got their first glimpse of their baby. According to an account by Albert's sister Maya, baby Albert had an unusually large and angular head, and his parents were even afraid that he might be physically deformed. But in time, the rest of Albert's little body caught up with the size of his head, and he became a fairly normal and robust child. This is the first known picture of Albert around the age of 3. And I guess this is the way they dressed little boys back then, at least for formal pictures. It's well known that Albert began to speak later than most children, at around the age of 2.5, when his little sister was born. At that time, after Albert's parents had told him that he now had a new toy to play with, he said to them in a full sentence, "Yes, it's very nice, but where are its wheels?" And let's see, here's a picture of Albert and his sister Maya. Later, when he spoke more fluently, little Albert adopted the curious habit of quietly saying every sentence to himself first before he would say it out loud. Therefore, it sounded like he was saying everything twice, once softly and once loudly. He spoke this way until he was 7, and he didn't become really fluent in speech until around the age of 10. Later in life, he claimed that he's always had a poor memory for specific words and names. This assertion isn't at all apparent in his many writings, which are often eloquent and full of amusing metaphors. During an interview for a book on how scientists and mathematicians think, he told a psychologist that he rarely thinks in words at all, that he first has a thought, presumably with images, and then he tries to express the thought in words. Maybe that's why he became so famous for his so-called thought experiments. At the age of 5, Albert's father showed him a compass, and seeing the needle move around on its own had a profound effect on the little boy. It was the first time he became aware that there are forces in the world that one can't see and that could make an object move. And he later said this experience made a lasting impression on him, as did a geometry book a family friend brought him several years later. Although Albert was usually a quiet child who liked to play by himself, he was prone to temper tantrums, sometimes striking out at his tutor and little sister, while his face turned red and his nose turned yellow in frustration or anger. He started to take violin lessons at the age of 6 until he was 14. Playing music seemed to calm him down, both as a child and also later in life, when he often played in string quartets and taught himself to play the piano as well. He was considered a fairly good musician by some, but others had their doubts. A professional violinist later claimed that Einstein fiddled like a lumberjack, and a famous pianist who played with him once shouted at him in desperation, "Albert, can't you count?" And a music critic in Germany, after hearing him play in a quartet for charity, and unaware that Einstein was famous as a physicist and not as a musician, judged that, quote, "Einstein's playing is excellent, but he does not deserve his world fame. There are many others just as good." Here's Einstein fiddling. After being tutored at home for a year or two, Albert entered a primary school in Munich, where his family lived at the time, when he was 6 years old. Because the southern part of Germany was mostly Catholic, the school was Catholic as well. And Albert, whose family was Jewish, was the only Jew in his class. Religious instruction was part of the school curriculum, so he became acquainted with Bible stories and the lives of the saints. At the same time, he was given lessons in the Jewish traditions at home by a relative, even though his parents were indifferent to religion. When Albert was 9 years old, he entered a German secondary school called a Gymnasium, which would prepare him to enter a university later. He remained something of a loner at the school, not forming any close friendships with the other children, whose companionships he didn't seem to need. Here, one of his teachers told him that he would never amount to anything, and another told him that he had a memory like a sieve. No wonder he began to dislike school, especially its strict teachers and inflexible German curriculum. Because the school focused on humanities, Albert's interest in math, in physics, math, and philosophy developed independently of his formal studies in school. Members of his family encouraged him to read widely in the sciences and in philosophy, and he became curious and excited about the natural world, often spending hours trying to solve mathematical problems in new ways. He also became quite engrossed in studying conventional religion, wanting above all to please God and following strict Jewish religious prescriptions, such as avoiding the eating of pork. But this interest came to a sudden end when he was about 12 years old and became better acquainted with the scientific process. He began to question religion and the stories in the Bible, which no longer made sense to him. And as he grew older, he also found the undemocratic hierarchy and authority of the church distasteful. But later in life, he developed his own kind of religion, based more on philosophy and a deep understanding of nature than on the Bible, blind faith, and institutionalized religion. He deplored those who thought of God as a miracle worker who can answer prayers, and once wrote to his friend Leo Szilard that as long as you pray to God and ask him for some benefit, you are not a religious person. To him, religion was to be found in the wonders of the natural world. Rumor has had it that young Albert was not a good student, but even though he showed no early signs of real genius, this is a myth. He received good marks, especially in the sciences and math, but his gifts did not become apparent until he did his innovative work in physics in his early 20s, when he looked at time and space, among other things, in a completely new way. He later insisted that he was more persistent and curious, not smarter than most people, looking at the world around him with the fresh eye of a child. This is Einstein as a teenager. Here he was about 14 years old. When Albert was 15, his family moved to Italy for business reasons, but they thought it would be best for Albert to stay in Munich with friends to finish up his years at the gymnasium there. This new situation left Albert very unhappy. He had already disliked the school and its rigid and authoritarian ways, and now, not having the love and support of his close-knit family, he was even more miserable. After a few months of anguish, he quit school without his parents' consent. All it took was a note from the family doctor saying he suffered from nervous exhaustion, and he boarded a train from Munich to Milan, where his parents were now living. Pauline and Hermann were no doubt surprised and conflicted when they found Albert on their doorstep one day, begging to stay with them. He promised he would study on his own to prepare himself for the entrance examinations to the Swiss Federal Polytechnical Institute in Zurich, called the Poly for short, where he wanted to study engineering or physics. His parents believed him and allowed him to stay. And Albert didn't let them down. He studied hard and was serious about his goals, and studying independently suited him well. He also loved living in Italy, sometimes taking off to go for walks in the northern mountains. Excuse me, need some water. It was around this time, when he was 16, that he first envisioned an experiment that would later lead to the theory that made him most famous, imagining what it might be like to chase a beam of light. From this simple thought experiment and many equations, and about 10 years later, he eventually came up with a special theory of relativity, which we're celebrating this year. Unfortunately, Albert didn't pass the entrance exam to the Poly the first time he tried, partly because he was only 16 and the normal age for admission was 18. He did very well in math and science, however, which impressed the admissions committee, but they also felt Albert should fill some of the gaps in his education. He agreed to spend a year at a secondary school near Zurich, and the year there passed quickly because Albert was having fun for the first time in his school career. He liked living among the easygoing Swiss, especially the family he stayed with. One of the daughters in the household, Marie, became his first girlfriend. The following year, when he was 17, he was admitted to the Poly, the best technical university in Europe, even though he was still a year younger than the other first-year students. At this time, having become enamored of Switzerland, and probably also wanting to avoid German military service, he decided to give up his German citizenship and to wait the required 5 years to become a Swiss citizen. Around this time, his independent spirit became more developed, and he began his lifelong dislike for anything having to do with being a soldier and with the military life, blindly following orders in general. So Albert did not become the ideal college student. He was easily bored, overly confident, rebellious and cocky at this time in his life, and he was sharply critical of others. He often skipped classes, preferring to study on his own and asking friends to take notes for him. He especially relied on his friend Marcel Grossman, a mathematics student who would later also help him with complicated mathematics and his theories. But he did go to his physics labs and in fact studied quite well on his own. He also became more sociable than he had been as a younger student and made several close friends. Among the new friends Albert made during his first semester was Mileva Maric, the daughter of a Serbian landowner and judicial clerk. Here's a picture of Mileva. Albert admired this older woman. She was 21 years old to his 17. For her intelligence, maturity, and determination to become a physicist at a time when very few European countries allowed women even to attend college. Mileva was thought to be not especially pretty, and she had a limp caused by childhood tuberculosis, but this made no difference to Albert, who fell in love with her despite her imperfections. The two would study together and discuss their research interests, and she would listen intently and critically as he described his ideas to her. They decided to get married after graduation when he had a job, even though his parents, who disliked Mileva very much, were opposed to the marriage and were certain it would fail. But things didn't happen as quickly as they had hoped. After he graduated in 1900, Albert tried to find a job as a teacher or research assistant, but had no luck. Here's a picture of Albert around this time. I think he was about 21 years old then. Part of the problem was that despite his brilliance in school, he had not been a favorite of the professors, and they weren't about to write good letters of recommendation for him now. This setback, however, didn't prevent him, in the meantime, from writing up his ideas and submitting his first scientific paper to a famous German physics journal, which published it in 1901 when he was only 22 years old. He also wasted no time in beginning his work on a PhD dissertation. He received his Swiss citizenship that year and now hoped his new status would help him obtain the teaching position he wanted. But he still had no luck and had to settle for temporary teaching positions and private tutoring, barely able to eke out a living and having to postpone his wedding plans. Then, to add to his anxieties further, Mileva became pregnant and returned home to Serbia to give birth in early 1902 to a daughter they called Liesel, a couple of months before Albert turned 23. Finally, that summer, 2 years after graduation, Albert found work as a low-level patent clerk in the Federal Patent Office in Belm, after the father of a friend intervened on his behalf. On this job, he would need to undergo a 2-year probationary period examining electrical gadgets before his position would become secure. But this was the best offer he'd had so far, and he took it. In many ways, he was suited to this kind of work because he had already had exposure to a variety of electrical items in the family electrical business. I have a picture here of Albert in his famous patent office suit. 6 months later, in January 1903, Mileva and Albert were married quietly in Belm after a courtship of almost 6 years, with only a handful of friends present. And this is their wedding picture. Albert was almost 24 and Mileva was 27. Now we come to a mysterious part of the young Einstein's life. It seems that his baby daughter, Liesel, born a year earlier, never came to live with her parents, but remained in Serbia, and Albert probably never even saw her. Albert's letters to Mileva while she was living with her parents during her pregnancy had shown that he was excited about the baby's birth and was making plans for their life together as a family. But soon after giving birth, Mileva apparently left Liesel behind in Serbia in the care of family or friends and returned to Belm to live with Albert. We don't know why she was left behind, but Albert might at first have felt that having a child without being married was scandalous and would hinder his search for a civil service job. Then, after he had already obtained a position, he might have feared he would be fired or not promoted. Or it could be that they were planning to bring Liesel to Switzerland to live with them as soon as their life seemed more secure and they could afford to marry. Or perhaps Liesel was mentally or physically impaired in some way and they couldn't take care of her. Then when Liesel was 20 months old, in September 1903, they heard from Mileva's family that the toddler had come down with scarlet fever, and Mileva took the train home to be at her side. Albert wrote to her that he's sorry about Liesel's illness and hoped it wouldn't leave some lasting effect on her. But from then on, all trace of the little girl was suddenly lost. There was no mention of her in any correspondence with friends or family, and no birth, baptismal, or death certificate has been found. And obviously, they didn't bring her back to Belm. So the best guess is that Liesel died during the scarlet fever epidemic that spread through the home village that fall. And Mileva returned to Belm to be with Albert. So no more letters were exchanged to shed some light on this mystery. At this time, Mileva was already pregnant again with her next baby, a boy named Hans Albert, who was born in May 1904. Here's a picture of the happy little family. A few months later, Albert's job at the patent office became permanent, and the Einsteins were able to settle down into a more stable family life. During this time, Einstein worked feverishly on 5 original and creative papers, including his PhD dissertation. He published them all the following year, in 1905, the year that came to be called his Annus Mirabilis, or Year of Miracles. He wrote not only these papers, the most famous of which became known as his special theory of relativity, and another which later earned him the Nobel Prize, but he also published over 20 reviews of other physicists' papers. Finally, in 1909, after 7 years as a civil servant, the young man realized his lifelong dream and became a full-time professor of physics at the University of Zurich. Though his name became well known among the top physicists in Europe who were intrigued by the young man's deep insights into physics, He wasn't yet famous. The following year, in 1910, 6 years after Hans Albert was born, the Einsteins added another member to their little family with the birth of a second son, Edward. Now, Edward was a fragile child for the first 10 years of his life, and Mileva often took him into the Alps, thinking that the fresh mountain air would cure him of his ills. Then he seemed to become hardier over the next 10 years and prepared himself for a career in medicine. But at the age of 20, Edward developed schizophrenia and was forced to give up his plans to become a doctor. He suffered from this mental illness throughout his life and died in a Swiss psychiatric hospital at the age of 55. Edward's older brother, Hans Albert, did well in life, eventually becoming a professor of engineering at the University of California in Berkeley. Over the next couple of years, Einstein's fame increased and he received a number of academic offers from all over Europe, and he decided to accept one from the Polytechnical Institute in Zurich, where he had gone to college himself, to begin in the fall of 1912. No doubt the old professors who had withheld their letters of recommendation were surprised that their former uppity student was making such great strides in his career. By this time, however, the Einstein's marriage was on the rocks, as Pauline Einstein had predicted. Albert seemed to have less and less time for Mileva and the children as his professional obligations increased and Mileva became moody and unhappy. Einstein's complaint about Mileva was that she took the joy out of his life with her sullen and brooding personality. And at times she seemed to bring out the worst in him, igniting his temper and causing him to say things to her that he may have regretted later. Now, feeling he no longer had a soulmate, Albert allowed himself to get involved in a romantic long-distance relationship with his divorced cousin Elsa, who lived in Berlin with her two teenage daughters, Ilse and Margot, who would become a big part of Einstein's life. So here's a picture of Ilse and Margot. Within a couple of years, Einstein was offered a prestigious research position at the University of Berlin, along with a directorship of a new Institute of Theoretical Physics, which would be established within a few years. No doubt, with a proximity to Elsa also on his mind, he accepted this offer and became a German citizenship again. Mileva did not want to go because she felt uncomfortable among the Germans, but she resigned herself to her fate and prepared the two boys for the move the following year in the spring of 1914. Just a couple of months after their arrival in the big city and shortly before World War I broke out in Europe, the unhappy Mileva realized that Albert was involved with Elsa and that their marriage was essentially ending. She decided to return to Zurich with the boys, leaving Albert to cement his relationship with Elsa and begin his new career in Germany without his little family. He was 35 years old at this time. This was a sad time for Einstein, at least for a while. He cried at the train station saying goodbye to his sons. He missed them and wrote warm and encouraging letters to them throughout the war years, even reminding them to brush their teeth, correct their spelling errors, and practice the piano. But he also made promises to them that he didn't keep, which made them upset and soured his relationship with Hans Albert especially. The war years were difficult in many other ways too, of course, especially with the lack of food in Germany, and Einstein now involved himself in pacifist activities and spoke up publicly and passionately against war. After a few years, Einstein was basically content to leave the boys' upbringing to Mileva, whom he did consider to be a good mother. Here's a picture of Edward and Albert in 1918. Edward is the other one. He continued to see Elsa during the war, but did not get divorced from Mileva until Valentine's Day 1919, marrying Elsa 4 months later. In the meantime, in 1916, Einstein had published his general theory of relativity, on which he had been working for several years, and which describes the force of gravity as a geometric warping in space-time. Skeptical scientists didn't accept his relativity theories immediately, because they were still thinking in terms of Newtonian physics, and it took time to readjust their thinking. But Einstein defended his work vigorously along with his supporters and spoke and published widely on the subject. The year 1919 therefore turned out to be a memorable one for Einstein. Not only did he get divorced, turned 40, and then remarry, but during the middle of the year, the theory of general relativity was confirmed by British astronomers during an eclipse off the coast of Africa. They were able to show that the gravitational pull of the sun bends starlight, as predicted by relativity theory. The results were published toward the end of the year, and the announcement made Einstein an instant worldwide celebrity. Most scholars agree that this is the time when Einstein's real fame began, at a time when the Great War had just ended and people were looking for new heroes whose discoveries might present them with a future full of hope and promise. Little did anyone know back then that, ironically, within 25 years, the discoveries of an ardent pacifist would result in the atom bomb. The next few years became a turning point in Einstein's life. His accomplishments brought him many accolades from around the world, even as others continued to argue over the general theory of relativity and conduct further experiments. Now, as a celebrity, he was invited to visit many countries. One of the first invitations came from the World Zionist Organization, headquartered in London. A few years earlier, he had been introduced to Zionism, at a time that anti-Semitism in Germany and elsewhere in Europe was on the rise. Einstein had always considered himself an internationalist and therefore did not agree with all the aims of the Zionist movement, which he considered too much of a nationalistic enterprise. However, he felt strongly that Jews should have a place to go where they could pursue their education without having to face prejudice. He therefore agreed to go to America for the Zionists in 1922 on a fundraising mission for a Hebrew university to be established sometime in the future in Jerusalem, in Palestine. When he arrived in New York, Einstein became aware how famous he had become and how much people admired him. Mayor John Hyland paraded him around the city in a motorcade and introduced him to the rich and famous. Here he is in a motorcade. He also gave a series of four lectures at Princeton University in New Jersey, and the press kept track of every step he took and everything he said and did. The fundraising didn't go quite as well as the Zionists had hoped, but Einstein now realized that a big new chapter in his life had opened, one in which he would have to learn to handle his overwhelming celebrity and not let it rule his life. For the next 10 years, he traveled the world. Besides making two more trips to America, he went to Palestine, Spain, South America, and the Far East, giving adoring crowds the lowdown on relativity. But during this time, his scientific contributions were otherwise no longer remarkable or cutting edge. Though he was celebrated for his genius and received numerous awards, including the Nobel Prize for 1922, his non-scientific interests became ever more important to him as he went through middle age. Incidentally, the Nobel Prize wasn't given for relativity theory, which was still too controversial at the time, but for Einstein's work on the photoelectric effect, which led to many technological innovations later on. Anyway, while he continued to contribute to the debate on quantum mechanics, and unsuccessfully searched for a unified field theory in which he hoped to express electromagnetic and gravitational theory within a single framework, he also became increasingly involved with social and political issues. He spoke out on pacifism, especially an end to compulsory military service, on the need for international reconciliation after the First World War, on a Jewish homeland and rights for Jews, and on the League of Nations. He also began to write on religion, education, and philosophy, often offending those who did not agree with him, including some colleagues. In the meantime, he found time to engage in a lively and lifelong correspondence with colleagues and friends all over the world, including the vegetarian and musical Queen Elizabeth of Belgium, whom he addressed as Dear Queen in his letters. His home life was stable, with Elsa providing him with the kind of undemanding companionship he needed, even while he was having affairs with other women, to which she seemed to become accustomed. He fell ill several times with stomach and heart problems, and Elsa faithfully nursed him back to health. Before the end of the decade, his son, Hans Albert, was married and had a child, and stepdaughters, Ilse and Margot, were married as well. These 10 years, of course, were difficult ones in Germany. The country experienced serious post-war economic problems after the harsh conditions set by the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I, and a steep inflationary period set in for several years, ending by the mid-1920s, during which German money became practically worthless overnight. Hitler's slow rise to power throughout the 1920s and the emergence and expansion of the Nazi Party brought on pronounced anti-Semitism. In 1930, Einstein stepped up his political activities, speaking out against increasing German nationalism and unrest as the Nazis emerged as the majority political party. The Einsteins traveled to the United States again in 1930, 1931, and late 1932 at the invitation of the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. This is Einstein at Caltech holding a puppet of himself. And here he is with a group of, they took a side trip to the Grand Canyon area. And here he is with a group of Hopi Indians, and Elsa is next to him. Oh, and the Hopis honored him with the title of the Great Relative. While Albert and Elsa were still in California in January 1933, the citizens of Germany elected Hitler as their chancellor, and the deportation of Jews began. Einstein was advised not to return to Germany. He became an official enemy of the state, and the Nazis put a bounty of 20,000 marks on his head. They discredited and burned his books and other writings and confiscated his house and bank account. Fortunately, he had already anticipated this possibility and kept money in foreign accounts. But he now became disillusioned with pacifism and warned the world repeatedly that Germany was heading for war, though it took another 6 years to happen. Einstein did not go back to Germany in 1933, but he did return to Europe. He spent several months in Belgium under the protection of his friend, the Queen, and another month in England. He gave up his German citizenship once again and resigned from all of his positions and affiliations in Germany, and was especially angry at his colleagues who didn't denounce Hitler's actions. In the fall, he and Elsa moved permanently to the United States, having accepted an offer that was proposed to him the preceding year by the director of Princeton's new Institute for Advanced Study. This is the institute today, but it looked the same back then. Ilse and Margot and Einstein's sons remained in Europe, the stepdaughters and their husbands in Paris, and the sons in Switzerland. Before leaving for Princeton, Einstein made his last trip to Switzerland to visit his ill son, Edward, in the psychiatric hospital. He would never see him again. And then Ilse died an early death in Paris in 1934. After which Margot and her husband also moved to Princeton and Hans Albert came to America with his family in 1939, as did Einstein's sister Maya. Einstein never returned to Europe. Einstein now began his American years. These are the years during which he left us with his enduring image of the kindly old grandfather. He and Elsa settled into their new home in Princeton. This is the home today on Mercer Street. But the happiness did not last for long. Within 3 years, Elsa became gravely ill and died of kidney and heart problems right before Christmas 1936 at the age of 30. She had never fully regained her joy of life and robust health after her daughter Ilse's death in Paris 2 years earlier. During the years that led up to World War II, the widower was able to live quietly in Princeton as he was undergoing so many changes in his life. The universities and the town's park-like grounds and beautiful ivy-covered buildings provided the calm surroundings for the intellectual and cultural atmosphere he cherished. But he often felt like an outsider, away from the European culture he had loved, no longer making major contributions to physics. He sought out friends, mostly from among the immigrant intellectuals and professionals who had moved into the area. Occasionally, he would tire of the rarefied environment of his Princeton neighborhood and stroll down into the working-class neighborhoods of the town to chat with his barber or a cleaning lady or gardener, no doubt for a dose of reality. I do the same sometimes. After Elsa's death, the divorced stepdaughter Margot took up lodging in his home, and a few years later, Sister Maya moved in as well. His secretary, Helen Dukas, also became his housekeeper, and now Einstein lived at home surrounded by a house full of childless middle-aged women who tended to most of his needs. Here there's Helen Dukas and stepdaughter Margot. His sister's not in this picture, but his dog Chico is here. Over the ensuing years, the widower became involved in a number of romantic relationships, went on fundraising and cultural events, took sailing vacations in upstate New York, on Long Island, and on the New England and Florida coasts, received honorary degrees, and enjoyed a full social life. Here he is receiving an honorary degree from Lincoln University, which is a black college in Pennsylvania that honored him for his opposition to racism. In 1939, Einstein, after having temporarily abandoned his pacifism and at the recommendation of other scientists, had sent a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt warning him that the discovery of nuclear fission that year would make it possible to build bombs that could set off an explosion unlike any ever seen before. He was afraid that German scientists would be the first to build such a doomsday weapon and wanted to give the American president a heads up on that possibility. Only a month after the letter was sent, World War II started in Europe. Roosevelt consulted his scientific advisors, who convinced him that the United States should embark on a program for the development of such a bomb as a possible defense or deterrent against Germany in case the United States entered the war. The American effort became known as the Manhattan Project and was set up at a huge lab in the desert of New Mexico in Los Alamos. Ironically, Einstein could not take part in this project himself. Though he became a U.S. citizen in 1940, he was not able to gain the necessary security clearance from the FBI to work on the highly secret and classified project. Even if he had, it's not certain that he would have participated once he learned it would be used offensively against Japan and not as a deterrent against Germany. His championing of what the U.S. government considered left-wing causes and friends for communist organizations once again brought him under a cloak of suspicion, this time in America. After the McCarthy era ended and the FBI had accumulated over 1,400 pages of material in his file, the agency was forced to admit it had no hard evidence that Einstein ever engaged in any subversive activities. In the meantime, the United States had entered the war in 1941. The bomb was built in great secrecy. Hitler committed suicide in his elaborate bunker in Berlin. And then, as we all know, two bombs were detonated over Japan. Once a uranium bomb over Hiroshima, and next a plutonium bomb over Nagasaki. This devastation brought the World War to an end in 1945. During those years, Einstein busied himself with humanitarian efforts to help Jews get out of Europe and to find positions for refugee scientists in America. The horrendous outcome of their four-year-long technological effort shocked most of the scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project. Many of them spent the rest of their lives speaking out against the global arms race and nuclear weapons in what was probably a guilt-motivated but futile exercise to ease their consciences. Others, such as Edward Teller, on whom the movie Dr. Strangelove was based, went on to help develop bombs that are even more powerful. As to Einstein, thanks to the FBI, he was truthfully able to say that he had done no work on the atom bomb at all. Still, he spent his final years trying to make sure another such weapon would never again be detonated. For this goal to become a reality, he envisioned a supranational organization whose purpose would be to control weapons worldwide. He believed that as long as individual nations had their own armaments, there would always be wars, and only a global organization should be allowed to hold these weapons and decide when or if they should be used. The year the war ended, Einstein also retired officially from his position at the Institute for Advanced Study. During the next 10 years, he supported the establishment of the State of Israel while warning its leaders that the Arabs must be treated fairly. He advocated universal disarmament and international control of weapons, became chairman of the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, which advocated the peaceful use of atomic energy, challenged McCarthy's witch hunts for communists, and continued to keep in touch with his many friends and fans all over the world. In 1952, Einstein was offered the presidency of Israel, which he declined, to the relief of those making the offer. And he also rejected the attempts of the German government and German organizations to honor him. In 1953, his health began to falter, and he became noticeably weaker, though still mentally alert. Here's a picture of the aging Einstein. In spring 1955, philosopher Bertrand Russell and Einstein signed a joint statement with other scientists declaring that the nuclear arms race must end, that there would be no winners in such a war. Appropriately, it was the last statement Einstein would sign. On April 15th, he entered Princeton Hospital with a ruptured aorta in his stomach. On April 18th, 1955, at age 76, while still on the hunt for his elusive unified field theory, Albert Einstein quietly died in Princeton Hospital during the early morning hours. Here we have his death certificate. Today, Einstein's offspring can be found in California, Switzerland, and Israel. Two of his grandchildren are still alive, as are five great-grandchildren, and at least half a dozen great-great-grandchildren. Oop, what happened to that other one? Can I get it back? Oh, I had a very nice cartoon of Einstein drinking a martini. I was going to say that I like to think that he's helping us celebrate his miraculous year, even though he never drank alcohol. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
me happy for that, so.
It's got the little cartoon bat with it.
Yeah. There it is. There.
There it is.
Thank you very much, Alice, for that very complete, brief overview of Einstein's life. We have time for just a few brief questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and one of our ushers will bring you a microphone right here in the front.
Can he tell us anything about what's happened to his family, his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren? Have they gone into science? Have they?
I don't think there are any scientists, as far as I know, among them. I know he has one great-grandson is a doctor, and I don't know what the others are doing, I'm afraid. His granddaughter, Evelyn, had a very checkered career. She was a police officer in Berkeley on the waterfront, and also an airplane mechanic. And a deep programmer for young people who had entered cults and were trying to come out. But I don't know about the others.
Other questions? There's a question over here. Right at the end of the aisle here. Mm-hmm.
How old was Einstein when he died?
He was 76 years old. He died about a month after his 76th birthday. Well, I must have answered all.
One last question right at the top here.
Thank you. If Einstein was evaluated today in terms of his social-emotional growth, would he have been considered to be autistic or Asperger's syndrome? Or do you think he was just like everybody else?
I think he was just like everybody else. I've heard that before, and I see no evidence of even Asperger's in his personality. I think one of the symptoms of Asperger's is the person has no sense of humor, and Einstein had a very sharp sense of humor.
Okay, Alice, I want to thank you again very much for your presentation this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. The exit is at the top to your left. Thank you.